silly thing. So, so tonight, 6 p.m.
Exam number 2 is going to open up. It's going to remain open until Sunday evening. I'm going to ask you to get it done sooner than later, though.
And your midterm grade will be just simply the average of the first exam and the second exam. I'm not going to do any convoluted math. Although I will factor in any extra credit that you earned through the submissions of chapter review questions or definitions, as well as anything you got from the start of the class. So if you have any of that coming to you, it will be factored in. What will not be factored in, though, is attendance. If you've gone over your allowed absences, that bonus, or rather that penalty, will be factored in at the end of the semester. Same thing true if you're one of the people who's still maintaining perfect attendance. If you had perfect attendance, you'll get that bonus at the end of the term. As far as the extra credit goes, just to circle back to that, make sure you get that to me by 11:59 on Sunday night, because I'm going to submit your midterm grades on Monday night, even though I'm supposed to do it tomorrow. I'm going to give you guys a chance to do a second exam. So if you did not do so well on the first one, you'll have a chance to improve your average. If you did good on the second one, this will give you a chance to do well again on the second exam to buttress your average. And of course, if you did well, don't bomb the second one. Don't pull that average down. And it is not cumulative. It's not like a half-year midterm exam. It's just another exam. So it'll be the same size, length, and scope as the first exam. And it will only encompass the information that we began when we were done with the first.
I think I covered anything. Did I miss anything?
All right, what I'm going to do at some point over the break, I'll also send out a list. I'll probably do it anonymously by numeric listed IDs, so that way you can't tell who's who. But I'll also give you an update on your attendance. So that way if you still get a zero, you'll get your zero perfect attendance. You'll know if you missed one or two or three or five or 12, although no one's missed 12. All right, so we left off talking about the last empire that we're going to cover. And similarly, like the Safavids, the reason why we're going to do the Mughals now is because we're talking about one of the Islamic states. But like the Safavids, they will be gone by the time we get to the third section of the class. The Mughals, of course, would come to dominate India. And the Hindus, of course, were the majority, and the Muslims were the minority. And one of the most interesting dynamics of the Mughal imperial timeline was how the rules of Islam were kind of fudged during the Mughal period. Meaning, the requirements in the Quran that pagans be destroyed were largely ignored. But we're not there yet. Let's talk about the second emperor, Humayun. Humayun was Babur's firstborn son. There was no requirement, as we said in Islam, that the firstborn succeeds. It just, in this instance, it happened to be the case. When Babur died, he was 22 years old, an adult. So the Mughal nobility basically said, yeah, we'll give him the throne. Unfortunately, unlike his father, he was a bad emperor. Bad, bad, bad. Why? He was a dreamer. He was a poet. He had no understanding of military affairs. He had no understanding of government affairs. He would just rather spend his time daydreaming, writing poems. He also was a drug addict, too. By the way, if you want to do drugs, don't plan on ruling an empire, because you can't rule an empire when you're stoned. Proof is Humayun. His reign, as it's covered a little bit in your book, was disastrous. So much so that for a brief period of time, the Mughals would actually lose control over much of India. His reign would actually be broken into two stints. During the first stint on his throne, his three brothers would actually plot against him and would launch a coup d'etat to try to take the throne for themselves. Why? Because he was a drug addict. None of his brothers were. Plus, at the same time, a bunch of Hindu chieftains were supported by the Portuguese, given guns to try to disrupt the Mughals so the Portuguese potentially could take control over a chunk of India. Ironically, it would be one of these Hindu chieftains that would actually overthrow the last of his brothers and would temporarily take control of the throne. It was chaos. It got so bad that Humayun only survived by fleeing to the Safavid Empire. And the Safavids almost killed him because he was a Sunni, not a Shia. So in order to stay alive, Humayun would actually convert to Shiism or face execution. But, long story short, after 15 years of chaos, when the last of his rivals died and there was no one else, he would actually make his return. The Safavids would give him soldiers, he would have a huge army, and he would reconquer the empire that was left to him, most of it, left to him by his father. But, ironically, he would die shortly after coming back to the throne. And here's a lesson that you should all remember for the rest of your days. Did you know that the stone towers in Europe and throughout much of Asia, the stairways descend going counterclockwise? Did you know that? The reason why they descend counterclockwise is the vast majority of people are right-handed. So you give your guards the advantage because the enemy running up a stairway will come under the assault of the defending soldiers who will be using their right arm, whereas the enemy, their right arm will come into the little stone part that's at the core of the stairwell. But anyways, why do I mention that? Well, he didn't come under attack, but in his palace, he had upstairs, or higher level, he had a vast library, because he loved to read books. So, he's coming down the stairs, stone stairs, in his flowing robes, with an armful of books. He then hears the Muslim call for prayer. So out of habit, he bowed his head down while walking down the stairs in his robes, holding a big stack of books. He also was a little stoned.
His foot gets caught up in his robes, he trips, and he literally broke his neck.
So, word of advice, not only don't get stoned, but if you do get stoned, don't wear robes. And if you do wear robes, don't walk downstairs carrying stacks of books around the time to pray, because you could end up dead.
Fortunately, despite the fact that this guy was a bad ruler, he did do one good thing. He produced a male heir.
And his son, Abu Akbar, would be regarded by world historians as one of the not only greatest Mughal rulers, but one of the greatest rulers ever on earth throughout time. He was a combination of his father, so he loved art, he loved culture, but he also was an interesting product of the influence of his grandfather as well. So he was a conqueror. He would come to the throne at the age of 13. He immediately focused on not only recapturing all of the territory lost during the reign of his father, but in time, when he died in 1605, he would come to control most of northern and central India. But it's how he conquered that makes him a worthwhile historical figure.
He realized you can conquer somebody with respect, with friendship, with tolerance.
Instead of trying to conquer and destroy, he focused on winning the hearts and minds of the majority of the population, the Hindus. For example, he would have over 1,000 wives, and the vast majority were Hindu. His goal was to make sure he had as a wife a daughter of every major Hindu chieftain in his realm. He also declared that not only Hinduism, not only Islam, but all religions would be tolerated in his realm.
And most amazing, he believed that all people should be treated equally. So regardless of your beliefs, he didn't judge you by your religion, he judged you by your actions. And if you obeyed the law, he ensured you had rights and you would be protected. He also didn't centralize his authority, but rather he created what political scientists refer to as a delegated government.
Meaning, he entrusted the people below him with duties and responsibilities. And if they did their job and obeyed his will, he didn't micromanage them. He let them make decisions. This went all the way down to the local level. Not only in the cities, but the smallest villages and towns. The only catch was, you had to answer to him. So, if you did your job and you reported everything was going fine, he left you alone. If you reported difficulty, he would try sending you help. If you did not report, or you were caught lying or cheating or being corrupt, you were removed and replaced. He also, unlike any of the Delhi sultans that came before, or even his grandfather or his father, he would actually elevate Hindus into the highest levels of government. Gave them positions of responsibility. Allowed them to advise him and make suggestions. He also abolished the jizya. Why should you have to pay to have your own faith? He also, as I said previously, he allowed local autonomy. So, for example, if you weren't a Muslim, you didn't have to follow Sharia law. Whereas elsewhere, like the Ottoman Empire, if you were a Jew or a Christian, you still had to obey Sharia law. The things that were prohibited by the religion for Muslims, you had to follow, even if you weren't a Muslim.
But in India, Abu Akbar, no.
So Hindus could not only self-regulate, but they could maintain their cultural and religious identity. He didn't need to control everything. Which again, for an all-powerful ruler in the 16th and 17th centuries, extraordinary. Nowhere on earth was there anybody like him at the time. I don't care if you're talking about Europe or the Middle East or Africa, even in the New World. He was the only one on earth that basically was libertarian with his people.
But if I had to paint a downside, he did grow a big ego.
So much so, he decided to break with conventional Islam and create a new state religion. Din-i-Ilahi. Din-i-Ilahi. Which loosely translates with Godism. But don't cheat. Don't do a Google search if you answer an essay on this and look up Godism, because Godism is not defined in Wikipedia the way Dini Allah Ilahi is. Dini, yes.
He's similar to Barbour? Or?
He's Barbour's grandson. Dini Ilahi is a jumble. I'll describe it like this. It was a cult in which he would make himself a deity. He was kind of like a Jesus-type figure. He didn't say he was a god, but he said he was son of God. And he blended Islamic and Hindu and Christian and Buddhist teachings. So it was a hodgepodge. A smorgasbord. Do you know what a smorgasbord is? Yeah, smorgasbord's yummy. Just kind of a mix and match. But here's the interesting thing about it. even though this would become the state religion, he never forced it on anybody. It never spread beyond the court. So it died when he died. The other thing that he did, again, ego-driven, was he would build for himself what in English is the City of Victory. Fatehpur Sikri. He would abandon Delhi and build a new capital for himself. This would be the earthly representation of Dini Ilahi. This would reflect, and I only put two pictures up. I should have done more digging. I've never gone. I want to go, though. This city was to represent the focus of the new faith, blending all of the best of all of the religions together. It is a synthesis of Hindu and Islamic and Christian and Buddhist construction. The city was massive. It was surrounded by 5 miles of walls. It had temples and mosques and Hindu shrines. There was a Christian church. There were libraries and public baths and housing. It was to be a free city where all mankind could live side by side in peace. Unfortunately, the city would only last for 30 years. Because Abu Akbar forgot something very important. When you build a city and you expect tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people to live in it, what do you need a lot of? And? Water. I got ice water in here. The city was built in a dry, arid region, and there was insufficient water to support a population. So literally 30 years after it opened up, it was completely abandoned. And that's the reason why it still exists today. Everybody left because there was no water there. And if there was no water, there was little to no food. And today it's recognized as a national historic site. Some point I want to go to India. Some point I want to see it. But we can call these two, you know, only the negative. Everything else was great. But again, even great people have egos. Question. Upon the death of Abu Akbar, his third son, Jahangir, would assume the throne. Now, I don't really have much to say about Jahangir, because really during this time, for the most part, everything was peaceful. Everyone was kind of getting along. And there's really nothing of historic consequence to talk about. Other than, on one hand, he officially declared that his father's religion of Dini Ilahi was no longer the state religion, but we were going back to Islam. But at the same time, he was going to continue his father's policy of tolerance. And just like it had during the reign of his father, his court included Hindus and Muslims. But because Jahangir, like his father, was a Shia, the court also had Sufis that would be allowed to come in, as well as Sunnis. But the Sufis were there, the people who inspired the Safavids. He also, in Fatehpur Sikri, would continue the construction, palaces and monuments, gardens and so forth. But he also beautified several of the other cities. Now, the most important development that occurred during his reign, and this is the reason why I put up there, put him in, was it was during his reign that the language of the Mughal Empire would be scripted. Urdu. Urdu is a classic example of the mindset of the Mughals. It is a language that uses Arabic writing, Arabic script. But it uses Persian vocabulary. So the words come from Persian. But the grammar is Hindi. So it looks like Arabic, but the words are Persian, but the grammar is Hindi. FYI, it is the official language of Pakistan today and is still used in much of India as well as Afghanistan. Questions? All right. Moving on. When Jahangir died, the throne would pass to his son, Jahan. Now, Jahan was born of Jahangir, whose father was a Shia Muslim, but it was with Jahangir's favorite wife, who was a Hindu. It was only in the Mughal Empire where if a Muslim married a Hindu, the Hindu didn't have to convert to Islam. So Jahan grew up appreciating both the religion of his father and his mother. And it was during Jahan's reign where the architecture of the Mughal Empire achieved its peak. And there is no greater example than the one structure in India, I guarantee you, you know, is in India. The Taj Mahal. It was Jahan that built the Taj Mahal. Question. Does anybody know why he built the Taj Mahal? Or what purpose it serves still, I guess, today? No idea? The Taj Mahal was built as a tomb for his favorite wife. It was meant to display stability, power, confidence. In its core is entombed the body of Mumtaz, who was his favorite wife. And this grand, opulent structure was built to symbolize, again, something you don't think about in the 17th century. Love. He built this out of love. He wanted to tell his kingdom that he loved her. In building it, he brought in artisans from all over the empire, as well as other parts of the Islamic world. There were calligraphers from as far away as Iran. There were fanal, the little flower-like makers that came from Uzbekistan. There were stone cutters from southern India. He got the best that he could find, and he put it on display. It would also be Yahan that decided Fatehpur Sikri was no longer a suitable site for the heart of the empire. So it would be Yahan who moved it back to Delhi. But he would invest in Delhi as much as his father and grandfather had invested in Fatehpur Sikri. He would build hundreds of mosques and libraries and temples and gardens and blah, 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 blah. In fact, carved all throughout the city are the words, and I quote, "If there is a paradise on earth, it is here. It is here." But that click right there lies the problem. If you spend money on beautiful things, where are you going to get the money from? Go into any city in our country today, and you will find statues and parks and libraries. And then scratch your head, thinking, is it worth it? Is it worth the price? And could the government spend that money on better things, like filling the potholes in the damn roads? Well, Yahan was of a mindset that this beauty was worth it. He spent so much money on the city that he almost drained the treasury entirely. Which, of course, put the defenses of the empire at risk. True story. My son's in the Navy. Do you know that our Navy today, in order to be supplied on a global level, relies upon a fleet of 67 ships? So they're not battleships, they're just transport ships. And of those 67 vessels, 30 of them were constructed during World War II. And of those 67 ships, only 20 actually run. And of those 20, 5 do not run well enough to sail more than 10 miles away from where they're in port down in Virginia. So long story short, if Joe Biden or whoever becomes the next president gets us in a global war, we're not going to be able to fight it because we're not going to be able to support our military. Because where has all the billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars that our federal government takes from us every single year go? Statues. and debit cards for all those illegal immigrants who are being put up in nice hotels. Why do I mention this? Well, Jahan would sow his own demise. Because any time the empire would come under threat, he would be forced to raise taxes. Which, of course, aggravated the people. Then, at a point when rebellions began breaking out, in 1657, he fell ill, which would set off a war of succession amongst his four sons. Because again, there's no rule in Islam that the oldest son has to follow. This civil war caused a massive amount of destruction within the Mughal Empire. But it would be his third son who in the end would beat his other brothers and would seize the throne in 1658. Aurangzeb. Now, unlike the other rulers that I talked about, Aurangzeb was a different cat. He, as soon as he assumed the throne, ordered his father to be arrested, and he would be kept under house arrest for the rest of his life. And when the old man would not die, Aurangzeb ordered all food to him to be stopped because it wasn't worth the expense because his father was too old. Now, why do I start off with that way? Well, if you read about Aurangzeb, the descriptions of him in the primary sources really depend upon the source that you read. He's like Donald Trump, or Barack Obama, or George W. Bush, or even Joe Biden. Your opinion is based upon who you read. So, Aurangzeb is talked about positively by Muslim sources. But he is one of the arch villains of all times if you read the Hindu sources. Oops, he's the throne to kill. He would rule for 50 years. So he would come to power in 1658 and he would remain on the throne until his death in 1708. By way of context, the Ming Dynasty has fallen. The Qing have taken control. At the same time, Tokugawa Ieyasu has seized control. He's been declared shogunate. And the war of all against all has come to an end. By the end of his reign, the Safavids were imploding. And it was during his reign that the Ottomans would be defeated at Vienna. Just FYI. To be fair, I will describe him this way. He was a strong leader. It was during his reign that the Mughal Empire reached its height. Do I have a map? I don't think I have a map. So let me go all the way back. Look at that, I clicked. I didn't have any maps in there. I should update this. Where's Babur? Asavid, yeah, go. Oh, there it is. By the time he died, he not only had the base of operations for Babur, he not only had the reign that would be acquired by Abu Akbar, but he managed to conquer the Deccan and almost all of southern India. He pushed the empire to its height. I'm just going to get back to where I was. He also brought back the practice of slavery. During his reign, he took countless slaves. Countless slaves. Because under Islam, if you are not a Muslim, slavery is fine. And he took them the old-fashioned way, through conquest. He would go in, conquer a village, and enslave the entire population. He also was a devout Muslim. He adhered to all of the rules established in the Quran. But most significantly, he brought an end to the policies which date all the way back to Babur of toleration. No longer was the Hindu community allowed to live under its own laws. The delegated government abolished. Hindus were removed from positions of government, all the way down to the local level. And all throughout the realm, only Muslims could be in position of power. Hindus would be required to submit. He would also impose the Sharia. Sharia law, as I believe I mentioned when I was talking about the Ottomans, Sharia law are the religious rules of culture. So in an Islamic country, these are the cultural rules that are based upon the Quran and the Shura. So what did this mean? Very simple. If you were a Hindu, you were forbidden to engage in all of those behaviors forbidden by Islam. So, you can't gamble. You're not supposed to drink alcohol. You're not supposed to do drugs. All behavior deemed questionable would be supervised by ulamas. So music, for example, had to be pre-screened to make sure it was not an insult to Islam. Relationships had to be pre-screened. Muslims were only allowed to marry Muslims. If a non-Muslim wanted to marry a Muslim, they had to convert to Islam. And by the way, the only ones allowed to marry non-Muslims were males. So a male could marry a Hindu, but that Hindu had to convert to Islam. Homosexuality, outlawed. Fornication out of marriage, outlawed. And of course, the jizya returned. And was collected regularly. He would centralize his power and would impose his faith upon the majority. He also was more austere. He abolished spending on artistic things. Unlike his father, Jahan, Aurangzeb had no interest in arts or architecture. He believed in practicality. So, FYI, I was on the school committee some time ago when my town decided it was going to build a new high school. And for a while I was on the building, the high school building committee. But I got kicked off because I kept challenging, why the hell do you have to put like like on the what they built a curve. And on the curve, they put like wood paneling that was meant to bend. And the wood actually would come from Israel. And like the mounting brackets came from like Poland or something like that. I'm like, don't make the building curved. Make the building rectangular and put bricks on the outside. Because you know what you don't have to do to bricks that you have to do to wood? You don't have to treat it. And if a brick falls off a building, you hire a mason. It's a 15-minute repair job. Our school ended up costing our town $60 million. Had my proposal gone through, I could definitely cut it down in half, and we would have ended up with the same amount of space. Well, Aurangzeb had the same mindset. Why are we going to waste money on statues and temples and shrines? Build row housing, build military barracks, put up a wall, and take the extra money and buy guns and cannon. He was, in many ways, not trying to be controversial, but it's truthful. He was, in many ways, similar to someone who was like Trump, as opposed to someone like Joe Biden. Aurangzeb believed that he was the keeper of the people's money and should only spend it on things for all of the people. So again, walls, guns, defense. Not fruity artistic things. It's the reason... What is it doing? I don't know what I just did. Whoa! It's the reason why during his reign, the Mughal Empire would reach the height of its power. The army was large. It was effective. But his rule was intolerant. His rule was violent. He wasn't respectful of people's opinions. He imposed his will. He also would implement high levels of taxation to help fund the wars. But unfortunately for Aurangzeb, the empire grew too big too fast to be effectively governed. So if you recall, I did the unit on how the British got into India. The British first arrived at the last few years of Aurangzeb's reign. And if you recall, at the Battle of Pliny, the animosity between the Muslims and the Hindus were exploited by Clive, Robert Clive. The Hindus were sick and tired of the Muslims, the Mughals. So they were willing to join with the British if that meant getting rid of the Muslims. This is exactly why. So again, we can talk about what he did that was effective, but there's the other side as well, because we have to be fair. The Hindus came to hate the Mughals, where just prior, they were willing partners. So it's no surprise that upon his death, the Mughals began to quickly decline. The Hindu kingdoms began fighting back. They began breaking away. And if you have one riot, it can be easily squelched. But if you have dozens of provinces suddenly break away and declare their independence, it's like trying to play, what is it, concentration? That's the spinning game with the dots, right? You know what I'm talking about? Where you got a, no, that's not concentration. What's that game? You've got the rubber, the mat that you put down, You spin the wheel. Twister, yeah. Yeah, it's like trying to get your hands and feet on all the dots in Twister. You just can't do it. Eventually you'll fall over. And that's essentially what would happen. But let's also not forget, like I referenced when I talked about the British entry, you had both the Brits and the French supporting these Hindu rebellions. They gave them money. They gave them weapons. They gave them training. Of course, in the end, the Brits would win over because the Brits gave the Hindus the best deal. But as a consequence, the entire empire would fracture. It would break apart. And in the end, the Mughal region slowly began to contrast. And the very last Mughal emperor, who was on the throne until 1858, was nothing more than a British puppet. Questions? Nothing? Watch. Boom. Well, now you don't have to worry about his name. So, this is it for exam number two. For those of you who are here at the beginning of class, you know what I'm going to say. A lot of people came in late. Like a lot of people have a tendency to do. Show up on time. Your exam, number two, must be taken before I submit midterm grades. Your exam will be an engage like the first exam. You will have a bunch of days to do it because I know we got baseball kids, we got softball kids. I just found out there were some hockey kids. And of course, all you guys and gals are going to go home. It opens up tonight at 6. If you can get it done tonight, great. If you can't get it done tonight, it will be open tomorrow. It will be open on Saturday. And it will remain open until Sunday. This is the most time I'm going to give you to take an exam.
Will the extra credit count for that same timeline too?
The extra credit will count for that timeline as well. So if you're working on the two chapters, the one that deals with China and Asia is two.
Okay.
And the one that deals with the Islamic empires, I will take that up until Sunday night.
That's the one that says Ottoman?
Yes, okay. Ottoman. There's
one that said Ottoman and there was like another, I forget, and there's one like Ming China.
Yeah, that's the other one. Yeah, so do those two chapters. Those must be submitted. If you haven't done those before, you can either just copy and paste your answers in, or you can send an attachment, or you can do, give me a link to Google Docs. Just make sure you put my email in there so I can open it up. Those must be in by 11:59 on Sunday. I'm supposed to submit my grades to the college on Monday, tomorrow, but obviously I'm not going to get it done. So your midterm grade will encompass an average of exam one, exam two, plus any extra credit stuff that you've done, going back to the first day of class. Question.
The extra credit stuff due Sunday is just the chapter review questions.
Chapter review questions, if you're inclined to do it. Now, obviously, I want you all to do well on this exam. If you've missed any classes, I suggest that you listen or get the notes before you try tackling the exam. Also, spend a few minutes trying to study. Some of you didn't do so great the first time around. If you can pull your average up, that would be wonderful. And the last, yes?
Is it the same type of test?
Same format. 30 multiple choice questions, two essays. One counts towards the test. The second is technically like a bonus question. But keep one thing in mind. Exam number one and exam number two only constitute 30% of your final average. So your midterm grade is not your grade in half the class. It's only 30%. So even if your midterm grade's a little low, you still have 70% of your final grade left to earn. So what I'm saying is don't freak out if you don't do so well. You got plenty of chance to rebound. And you got more extra credit. You got the paper and we got two more exams. Yes?
If I get it done earlier? Well, I have to wait till Sunday to see my
grade. I'm not going to grade them until Monday.
Okay.
Because I may grade it beforehand, but it doesn't open up until all of the exams are graded.
Okay.
So, yeah. So please get it done early. That would be great, because I'll have a chance to get it done early, and that would be wonderful. Rather than me trying to grade three classes exams on Monday, if I only had to do like 10 students, that'd be sweet. All right, any other questions? All right, I'm going to give you all, yes.
You said we can do only Ottoman and then China.
Yes. Yeah. The first Muslim chapter, because there's two in there. The first one, and then the first one on China as well.
And then Mughal as well.
And the Mughals, yeah, and the Safavids, that whole chapter. All right, I'm going to tell you all the same thing that I tell my kids whenever they leave. Don't be dumb. In other words, have a wonderful vacation, and don't do anything stupid. We'll see y'all when we get back.